Our story today comes from Matthew chapter 2. So we'll start there. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least of the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So the series we're doing in Advent is thinking about various Christmas carols or Christmas hymns and sort of thinking, you know, what can we draw out of them and learn the lesson? And so today we're doing the hymn We Three Kings. And We Three Kings is kind of an interesting hymn, right? It's sort of this fun little hymn. It's like a standard sort of stock hymn about these sort of kings going to visit Jesus and so on. The history of it is not as exciting. You know, when Chris Raker talked about how this really interesting history, this one, some guy wrote it in the mid-1800s, and it instantly becomes a hit. That's sort of the entire story of the history of We Three Kings. And you can sort of see, you know, it's sort of this, well, the other notable thing is, according to Wikipedia, that source of all information, it was the first big Christmas carol coming out of America, so we can take some justifiable pride in it, I guess. But sort of you can see why this hymn is so awesome, right? We are three kings from the Orient, and we're going to show up, and we're going to do this thing. And if you think about a nativity scene, right? You get the nativity scene, there's all these little characters in the nativity scene, and there's no doubt who the coolest people in the nativity scene are, right? It's these kings, right? Because they look great, and they've got these wonderful gifts, and then you get the kind of guys all dressed up rustically. But the three kings, in anyone, man, they're the most awesome. They're the ones you always want to see. Man, how elaborate are they, or so on. And so you can see why the hymn is so great, because it sort of captures everything exciting about that nativity scene. You know, I mean, I know we're supposed to be excited about the little baby, but the baby looks like a baby. The kings look awesome, and they're colorful, and they've got gifts, and we're really excited about it all. And the nice thing about it, then, is we got this great moment in this nativity scene, and then you think about this song about these three kings of the Orient coming, and then we realize just about nothing about this story is true, right? The number three. There is nothing in that account in Matthew that suggests there are three kings that have come to see Jesus. Nothing, right? It's like 600 years later is the first time anybody says, hey, there was three of them, and the entire genesis of three of them are, they're bringing three gifts, gold, frankincense, myrrh. And obviously, if you have three gifts, you must have three givers. Boom, done, right? These guys, 600 years afterwards, by the way, get named, right? Suddenly, we've discovered their names. I don't know how. I mean, I would love to know how somebody figured out their names of these three guys. So we have these three guys, but there probably weren't three. Well, maybe there was, but it'd be some coincidence that there happened to be three of them. The second thing we know about them is they're not kings, right? This actually comes before the number three. It was a couple hundred years later somebody said, hey, you know what? These guys, they must be kings because they must be really, really important, and kings must be really, really important. But they're not identified as kings anywhere in this account. They're not identified as wise men either, by the way, right? They're just these magi, right? So we've got three, well, not really. Kings, well, not really. And then they're showing up in this stable, well, not really. As the account says, they don't go to a stable, they go to a house, right? They're not showing up in the stable at all. They're not there with the shepherds and the baby in the manger or anything like that. We have a completely different story here of some unknown number of non-kings showing up at some unspecified time that is not Christmas Day at all. Oh, and by the way, we have no idea if Christmas Day is even in winter, right? And so we have these guys showing up, and you realize sort of, this is odd then. We've got this image seared in our mind of the three kings coming and seeing Jesus as he's born in this manger, and that's not at all what there is going on in this story. What is going on in the story? Well, it turns out it's even weirder when you start trying to figure out what's going on in the story. The first thing is they're not kings, they're magi.
So what the heck is a magi, right? I mean, you sort of get these magi, right? And, you know, it's sort of this nice thing. This is not a common thing to go around talking about magi. But it turns out Herodotus, the Greek historian, has a big section about magi. In about 550 BC, right, there was this sect of magi in the Persian Empire that were like the court kind of priests kind of thing. And they would sort of interpret dreams, and then they took over for a little while or so on. And that's about 550 years before Christ is born. Then they vanish from the scene. And the word magi, 500 years later, is sort of used as this kind of like loosely like, it's some sort of magician or astrologer or somebody that goes around kind of telling tales or prophesying the future or something. And the magi, it's like this motley collection, right? There's some of them are like earnest, sincere believers trying to discern truth, right? They're like Doctor Strange kind of thing. You know, you sort of imagine them, they're really trying to figure this out, right? And then others of them are like charlatans and frauds rolling in the town, you know, like palm readers or something like that on the street corners. And so we have these magi. We can't even tell from just the description of magi then, are they respectable people or sort of disreputable characters, right? I mean, when they roll into town, there's no reason to think, wow, these guys are amazing. They may have been, the common impression may have been, these guys are a little disreputable. So we have these guys rolling in. Then they're following this star. This is also really weird. Nobody can figure out what that means, right? You follow a star to go find this birthplace of Jesus, because we all know, right, if you go out and you stand directly under a star, you know, hey, I'm right under that star, right? And so, have you ever tried to stand right under a star? Like, where would you stand if you wanted to stand directly under a star? I haven't a clue how to figure this out. And it turns out, nobody has a clue how to figure out what does it mean to have this star directly overhead, right? Because it always looks like they're kind of overhead somewhere. Plus, I don't know if you've noticed, but the world turns, so stars are constantly moving in the sky too, right? And so you're directly under it all the time. I mean, and so then people are saying, well, I don't know what this star thing is, right? And then it's so shining so brightly, it's like some supernova, right? And so some star explodes and it got extra bright hanging somewhere, I mean, nobody knows. So people have tried all of this, well, maybe it was just planets all aligning up kind of thing. And that sounds kind of neat. Well, maybe the planets align, you can figure that out. Except there are no planets perfectly aligning anywhere remotely around this time period that we could figure out. Plus, they all knew the difference between stars and planets back then, and so it would be weird to say, well, they were following. So we don't have a clue what it means to have these magi following this star. The star, incidentally, shows up. They see it. They go. They get to Jerusalem. And then they leave Jerusalem to go to Bethlehem, and it leads them to and then stops over the place where Jesus is, which isn't the manger. Remember, it's a house now. And I mean, it's just, you know, makeup story, right? Because we have no idea how this all works. And then you start imagining this story. And by the time we're done looking at it, you realize it's a lot like this. Imagine you had a baby, and then one day, there's a knock at the door, and a bunch of hippies are standing out there, and then they sort of say, hey, we heard you had a baby. Here's a whole bunch of gifts for you. That's the scene of the three wise men, right? And it is an odd scene when you get right down to it. And Matthew leads with it. He doesn't have that whole shepherds and angels thing at all. This is the story Matthew tells about the birth of Jesus, which is sometime after the birth of Jesus. And so what are we supposed to do with this story, right? I mean, it's kind of a weird story when we really look at it. And you can see then why the manger scenes and the nativity sets are way more popular than the real story. Because, you know, having this other real story does not get you a great visual, right? It's just sort of, yeah, I'm not quite sure what this is all about, right? So we have this thing going on. What makes this thing so important? Well, it turns out this is one thing the author of We Three Kings got right. He got the three and the kings part wrong, right? But he got the sort of important parts of the story right. And the first important part, there's two things about it that are really, really kind of crucial. The first part of it is, it shows up in that first verse. They're sort of traveling, you know, they're here with the kings, we're traveling afar, field and fountain, moor and mountain. And that sort of idea, that they're sort of traveling over this long distance. And this was an idea that the Nativity set masked, and it wasn't until I was much older that it finally dawned on me to think about their journey, right? You hear the story of the shepherds. Angels show up, they pop over, and they go see Jesus, right? Then the three kings, because they're also there, it sort of looks like, hey, they just showed up too, right? But how did they get there? And it wasn't until I was reading T.S. Eliot much later, right? And he has a poem called Journey of the Magi that it hit me. And T.S. Eliot starts this poem by ripping off from a sermon by Lancelot Andrews, somebody who I've never heard of other than in the reference of this T.S. Eliot poem. Lancelot Andrews preached a sermon in the 1600s.
And in this sermon, it was one of his Christmas sermons. In his sermon, he writes this. So I have to stand behind a pulpit, because if you're reading a sermon from 1600s, you got to stand still. So, no, you do. It's like a rule, right? To look a little on it. In this, their coming, we consider, first, the distances of the place they came from. It was not hard by as the shepherds, but a step to Bethlehem over the fields. This was riding many 100 miles and cost them many a day's journey. Secondly, we consider that the way they came, if it be pleasant or plain and easy, for if it be, so much the better. This was nothing pleasant, for through deserts, all the way waste and desolate, nor secondly easy either, for over rocks and crags of both Arabias, especially Petra, their journey lay. Yet if safe, but it was not, but exceeding dangerous, as lying through the midst of the black tents of Kedar, a nation of thieves and cutthroats, to pass over the hills of robbers, infamous then and infamous to this day. No passing without great troop or convoy. Last we consider the time of their coming, the season of the year. It was no summer progress. A cold coming they had of it at this time of year. Just the worst time of year to take a journey, especially a long journey in. The ways deep, the weather sharp, the days short, the sun farthest off, the very dead of winter. And these difficulties they overcame, of a wearisome, irksome, troublesome, dangerous, unseasonable journey. And for all this, they came. And you start imagining that journey, and that's what Eliot starts doing when he wants to write the Journey of the Magi. So I can walk around now and I'm reading Eliot. He starts his poem this way. A cold coming we had of it. Just the worst time of year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep, and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melted snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terrace, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out, and the lack of shelters, and the cities hostile, and the towns unfriendly, and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Imagine that journey through treacherous terrain, riding camels with just dirt and disease. It's just a mess, and it's miserable. And the whole time, what are you doing? You're doing this journey because you saw some sign in the heavens that there was this king born, and you embark on this difficult, painful, tedious journey all the while, and you can imagine it. What am I doing this for? Right? You're in this trek and you're going, and day after day after day, you're like, why am I doing this again? Oh, yeah, there was this king. And then you get up and you're riding your camel for hour after hour after. This is a hard trip they took to go see this king. And then they get to their destination, finally. And you can imagine the relief they felt when they finally arrived in town, Jerusalem. They went to Jerusalem because if you want to go find a king being born, where do you go? You go to the capital city. And so they go to the capital city, and you can imagine it finally comes into sight, but it comes into sight and it's not in like 2 minutes in, right? And then you got to plod and plod and plod and plod. And you finally get into the city. You've been going through this long, painful trip, and you get there and you roll in, and there's no banners everywhere, and there's none all that. And then you're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And you're saying, where's this king that was born? And everybody looks at you like, what are you talking about? And they say, oh, no, 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 we saw this star. And they're like, what are you talking about? There's no king being born. We have a King Herod, and he's not a really nice guy. He's murdering his sons, by the way, right? But it's literally, right? I mean, they sort of have this weird king. But he's not having any kids anytime soon, right? And he doesn't have any kids, and nobody knows anything about any kids. And now you think, what are you thinking when you're this magi that just showed up after this long, hard journey? And there's no king being born after all?
And you start asking around, and nobody's heard anything about this. And then the king finally hears, and he calls you to the palace, and you're thinking, well, good, maybe we'll get some man. And you show up, and you're thinking, oh, maybe there's like secret baby, but there's no secret baby. And then the Herod goes, and he says, like, where is it? So he comes to you. Now, you can imagine, you've gone through this long, painful journey. You finally arrive at the capital. You're finally talking to the king. He says, I don't have a kid, right? And he says, oh, by the way, I talked to my court counselors. We know where the baby was supposed to be born, in Bethlehem. And Bethlehem has got to be one of those are you kidding me moments, right? Bethlehem, again, it gets masked with our nativity scene. It always looks so nice. Bethlehem is a nothing town. It may have a population of 500, right? Think about 500. There are four times more Mount Holyoke students than the number of citizens of Bethlehem. And you've just made this long, painful journey. You show up in the capital city, and now they are sending you off to where? This isn't even on the map, let's be clear, right? I don't know if they have map, right? But it's not there, right? I mean, it's just like, there's not. And now they go out, and then suddenly the star appears again, right? And they're all excited about that because, hey, maybe this is right. And then they finally roll into Bethlehem after this long, long journey. And then when they get there, they show up at a house, not a temple, not a throne room, not a palace, a house. And there's a carpenter and his wife and a baby. And what are you thinking now if you're them? Did I get the right address here, right? And then what do? They hand over gifts. Gold, incense, myrrh. They hand them over. Now, think of the faith involved in this entire journey, just to make the whole trip, to get to Jerusalem, to be utterly crushingly disappointed, to go off to the middle of nowhere, to find a house where all you see is mom, dad, baby, and you are so confident this must be right, you hand over these gifts. The gifts themselves also turn out to be interesting. Firstly, because they're not that interesting. If you think about the Magi handing over these gifts, we always imagine, oh, gold, frankincense, myrrh, it must be something great, right? But if you look at sort of what we would be doing in that time, gold, incense, myrrh, these are just common trade goods, right? If you're a trader and you're traveling long distance, gold is a really useful thing. It's one of the first things we see monetized. People use it. And we think it's monetized because it's a soft metal. You can use it for jewelry, but you can also mold it and divide it and so on. So it's a really useful thing to travel with. And then incense, myrrh, like spices later on, if you need to be carrying something a long distance that's worth something, things that are small and compact and lightweight are really, really useful. So the spice trade, you know, and the East India Tea Companies and all of these sorts of things was all about having these things that you can carry very large, expensive amounts of that are very light and transportable. So if you're going to travel a long distance across dangerous terrain and bring gifts to a new baby, bringing gold was normal and obvious, right? But then bringing things like incense and myrrh is also sort of obvious at the time. And so they show up and they hand over these valuable gifts. Now, you think about handing over these valuable gifts. If these things had any quantity at all, Mary and Joseph just became very wealthy, right? And we always think of them as very, 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 very poor, right? But at least at that moment, they became very wealthy. They had a lot of something there. They get these things. But then later on, when people start looking at the gold, incense, and myrrh, they begin to realize, you know what? Maybe there's something important about these three gifts. And the important thing turns out to be, why is Matthew telling us the three things they brought? And it turns out Matthew is a very clever writer. So he's writing this thing, right? And he says it's gold and incense and myrrh. And then people begin to say, well, do these have any meaning? Do they have any symbolism? And it turned out later church historians and the theologians start saying, yes, they have enormous symbolism and meaning. And that's where our hymn comes in very handy, because he captures exactly what people began to think about it. So the We Three Kings hymn, right? It starts off with that first verse, which just says, hey, we're traveling, right? And that's the important thing. The next three verses are about the three gifts, right? And you get the three gifts. When it was originally written, the idea is you have three guys, they sing the first verse together, then they each have a solo for verses 2, 3, and 4, and then they all sing the fifth verse together. That was sort of the design of it, right? And so you can imagine now the three different guys chiming in. And the first guy comes on, he says, born a king on Bethlehem's plain, gold I bring to crown him again. King forever, ceasing never, over us all to reign. Gold symbolizes kingship. And that's not a big stretch, right? Crowns and gold and being a king. And now we're bringing gold, and it symbolizes that Christ is the king. Second, frankincense to offer have I. Incense owns a deity nigh. Prayer and praising, all men raising. Worship him, God on high. Incense is heavily associated with religious rituals, right? You go into the temple, and the priests are constantly burning incense to God, right? And so you bring incense, and it symbolizes both the priestly role of Christ, that he's now a priest and he's going to be offering incense, but it also signifies the divinity of Christ. He's the recipient of the incense. And so we're offering gold, symbolizing that Christ is a king. We're offering incense, symbolizing that he's the priest. Myrrh is mine, its bitter perfume, breathes the life of gathering gloom, sorrowing, sighing, bleeding, dying, sealed in the stone-cold tomb. Myrrh symbolizing death. Christ is the sacrifice. He's going to die at the end of all of this. And you watch sort of what Matthew does, these themes that Christ is the king, he is the priest, and he is the sacrifice, turn out to be three themes straight through the book of Matthew. He is constantly returning to sort of the kingship of Christ. He is constantly returning to sort of the divinity or priesthood of Christ. And he is constantly returning to the sacrifice of Christ. All three of these things show up in the entire Matthew's narrative of the death scene, right? He goes on trial twice in Matthew, right? The first time between the high priest, and the big question is, are you really divine? Are you really the temple? Are you really a priest? And the answer is, yes, I really am. Right? The incense was an appropriate gift. And then he goes before Pilate, and the question is, are you really a king? Are you really the king of the Jews? And the answer is yes, the gold was an appropriate gift. And then when he's on the cross, he is offered wine mixed with gall, and he tastes it and doesn't want to drink it, right? As Mark notes, it's wine mixed with myrrh. That's the sort of bitter thing in the wine, and they would offer this to sort of deaden the senses as you're being crucified to make being crucified a little bit less painful, right? And so myrrh shows up right at the crucifixion, and then as John tells it, when he's taken down for the cross and he's wrapped up in linens dipped in myrrh. So there's all this association of myrrh with the sacrifice of Christ. And we see these themes, and it's like Matthew's sitting down. He could have written the story saying these guys show up and they hand over gifts. But he doesn't just say they hand over gifts. He says they hand over gold, they hand over incense, they hand over myrrh. And it's like this sort of beautiful little introduction saying, hey, there's the themes. You know, you want your theme for your book. We've identified the themes. And you can imagine now all the kids that have been assigned trace the theme of gold, the trace of incense, and the trace of myrrh straight through this story. And you can find it running straight throughout. And then we realize something really amazing. As soon as we start looking at the story of these three kings showing up, right, at this thing, and we say, well, it's not that, it's something different. And we say, you know, Matthew, in telling this story, wasn't meaning us to think about the nativity scene. He's meaning us to have something that we're going to follow through the whole book. We notice something else fascinating about it. You look back at Matthew chapter 2. And as you look at Matthew chapter 2, this curious sentence, you don't notice it's a curious sentence, but it turns out to be. Matthew chapter 2, in verse 11. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. They saw the child, and they worshipped him. And this doesn't strike us as particularly, I mean, it's what we would expect, because we've heard the story a million times. They saw, and they worshipped. First thing that happens in Jesus' life, in Matthew's telling. Now turn to the last chapter of Matthew, Matthew chapter 28. Jesus has come back from the dead, and in verse 16, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshiped him. And we suddenly get the exact same theme coming back. It's right at the beginning of Jesus' life, they saw and they worshiped, and then at the end of his life, they saw and they worshiped. But note what he says. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And again, this triggers this huge recollection of the story of the Magi. The story of the Magi is these guys who are going to show up and worship him. They believe. They travel all this distance. But the first person they meet isn't Jesus. The first person they meet is Herod, who doubts. He doesn't believe this story. He has no interest in this story. There is a sharp divide in that first story between those who see and will worship and those who see and will not. And you realize what Matthew has done is he started off saying, here's something interesting. The first people who are going to show up and worship Jesus are not Jews.
They're not the people of Israel. The first people showing up are people from elsewhere, from the east, who have traveled all these distances, and they show up, they see Jesus, they worship him, and then what do? They hand over gifts. And back in Matthew chapter 28, when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." In heaven, where God is, in sense, and on earth, where earthly rulers, where kings and gold rules, all authority on both heaven and earth has been given to me. Why? Because of this sacrifice I did. Exactly the same three themes. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age. End of gospel. What just happened in this gospel? It starts with people coming from afar. They travel to Jesus and offer him gifts. And it ends with Jesus saying, "It was appropriate for you to give me these gifts. Now this is what you need to do. Go back out through all the world and return the gift I am now offering to the rest of the world." The story starts with people coming from all over to bring gifts to Jesus, and it ends with Jesus sending a gift out to the rest of the world. And this gift out to the rest of the world is, "I am indeed the king and the priest and the sacrifice. I am all of these things together." Matthew's gospel is clever when you think about it. I mean, he is wrapping up the entire gospel message right here in the story of the Magi. And we look at these Magi showing up, and what have they done? They've engendered great turmoil and great trouble and great struggle, all because they wanted to see Jesus. And when they see him, they want to offer him everything. They want to offer him all these gifts. And then Jesus accepts those gifts and then turns around and hands back the most magnificent gift ever and says, "Go out and take this everywhere in this world." We think about the Magi all the time as a guy just sitting there in the nativity scene, but they are amazing role models for us. And if you think about the Magi as a role model, and then you think about your life, well, I know it makes me depressed to make that comparison, right? Because the Magi endured great hardship, heading off on a journey they really didn't even know what they would find, having absolutely no promise of success, and they go through all of that in order to be able to give a gift. And what do I want out of this whole relationship? I want my easy and having gifts given to me. Lancelot Andrews, this was a big shock to me because I only know about the P.S. Eliot part. At the end of this sermon, he says this, "And we, what should we have done? Our fashion is to see and see again before we stir a foot, especially if it be to the worship of Christ. Come, such a journey at such a time? No, but fairly we've put it off till spring of the year, till the days longer, and the ways fairer, and the weather warmer, till better traveling in Christ." That was written in the 1600s, by the way, not the 21st century, right? That's the journey I want. I want this easy journey. I don't want toil and struggle and trouble. And I don't want to be thinking that the point of all of it is to give gifts to God. I like it much better thinking of the Christmas story as it's just about the other way. God gave me this great gift, right? And he gave me that great gift, and now I can just sort of enjoy it. And I don't really have to go through any toil or trouble or struggle ever in my whole life. And then Jesus is saying to all of us, "Look, I've given you this gift. Go into all the world and share that gift with everyone else." And you know what? It may not be easy to share it with everyone else. It may not be easy to tell people what's going on at Christmas. It may be hard. It may be pain. And you may not even know what the point of it all is. You may spend day after day after day thinking, "This is all folly." But you know what? Christ has given us this gift. Let's share that gift. Let's pray. God, we stand in awe. We stand in awe of the journey that the Magi made to see you. But God, we stand in even greater awe of the much larger journey that you made to see us.
So before we close, be sure to enjoy the next week. I know that the people get very stressed out and all, but just enjoy. It's Christmas, Reverend, right? I mean, this is a great day. It's also, you can note this, right? The wise men, the traditional date the wise men came was 13 days after Christmas, because Christmas actually was traditionally the start of the 12 days of Christmas. So we really would have 12 straight days of Christmas that we'd be looking forward to. Santa Claus ruined all that, by the way, because he got so excited on Christmas Day that, like, you know, what do you do after Santa's been there and so on? But anyway, so you can imagine starting 12 days of festivities is what we'll be starting next Monday. So don't wear yourself out in the next week. Just enjoy it. In the closing, glorious now, behold him arise. King and God and sacrifice. Alleluia, alleluia. Earth to heaven replies. May God be with you all this week. Merry Christmas to you all, and please join us for coffee in the back.